This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. How much does racism cost Australia? I mean, literally, how much does it affect our economy? Because it does. We'll get to that a bit later. We'll also get to sunshine priming. Turns out to have quite an effect on decision making. Let's start with Victoria. As you'll be aware, our second largest state is about to have a second week of lockdown. Well, Greater Melbourne is. And for the people who can't work because of that, there will be some federal help. $500 a week if you usually work 20 hours or more, $350 if you work less. You won't get it if you have $10,000 in liquid assets. So is it enough? And how much is the lockdown costing? I put those questions to the chief executive of the Grattan Institute, economist Danielle Wood.
Look, I think enough is a difficult concept. I'm sure there are people out there that have had their hours cut to zero that are going to be taking an income hit even with a $500 a week payment. But it is probably enough for most people to get by. It's, you know, sort of slightly higher than the single age pension. So you can survive on it. And I think, you know, it will be enough, hopefully, to help people pay the bills. But certainly no one's going to be living the high life on a payment of that size.
People can apply, I think, from Tuesday. Given how long these things take to happen, how much do you think it'll help?
Look, I think it's absolutely crucial. We've got more than 500,000 casual workers in Victoria. About a third of them are in hospitality and retail. And so realistically, I think we have hundreds of thousands of workers that have had hours cut during this lockdown, many of them hours cut to zero. And, you know, that idea of leaving people with little or no money to live, including paying their bills, is not very palatable, I think, to most Australians. So those people are facing really emergency circumstances. So it's incredibly important. And, you know, quite frankly, I think it's the right thing for us to do. You know, lockdowns are there. They're awful, but they're there to help all of us. And I don't think there is any reason why we should ask a subgroup of workers, you know, including some of the most vulnerable workers, to bear the cost on behalf of Victoria or Australia.
Would it have been better then, Danielle, if it had been a JobKeeper 2.0? Because it's not as much money. It doesn't have that sort of specified intention of maintaining a link to the employer.
The level of the payment is set at the level that JobKeeper was in its third incarnation. It was at the 3.0 version between January and March, not as high as the original JobKeeper. And as you say, it doesn't maintain the link to the employer. I suspect it's not as big an issue for these shorter lockdowns if it's done in conjunction with business cash flow support. So what employers really need is the money to continue to pay their permanent workers. So they are getting some support to do that through the Victorian government scheme. Most of them, though, I suspect, you know, with that type of support will stick it out with their workers. The real issue has been getting support to casual workers that have had their hours cut. That wouldn't necessarily happen through a JobKeeper type scheme. You'll remember that the original JobKeeper excluded short-term casual workers. So you would either, you know, if you wanted to introduce a JobKeeper scheme, it would need to either be re-engineered or it would have to be done in conjunction with changes in JobSeeker that kind of recreates that full safety net that we saw in place last year. But I think, you know, as long as lockdowns are short, this combination of business cash flow support and payments to workers should do the job.
Do we know how much the lockdown's costing the economy? And I'm aware, of course, that this is scale is what's important here. It's obviously having a big impact in Melbourne and a smaller impact across Australia.
So we did a sort of a back of the envelope estimate for Victoria, looking at what we saw was the hit to economic activity in the second big lockdown that we experienced here in Victoria compared to a pre-COVID baseline. So we found that a lockdown for a week costs about $900 million across the Victorian economy. Treasury estimates said about $700 million, which I think is for the metro area only. But, you know, whichever way you cut it, it's particularly costly. For the rest of the country, you know, clearly there is still some cost, even though it's not the very direct cost that Victorians face. You know, Victorians like a holiday in Queensland this time of year. You know, I personally cancelled a work trip to Canberra today. There would be spending by Victorians that wouldn't be happening because of these lockdowns. But, you know, really I think the bigger cost of the lockdown is in terms of certainty. So we are really relying on high levels of confidence to get consumers and businesses spending again. So Treasury estimates, for example, that consumption is going to grow at 5.5% a year from July. That relies on people being willing to spend down the savings that they've accumulated during the last year. And that really only happens when people have certainty about their jobs, when they feel that the economy is strong. And I think really that the lockdown shows that we're not out of the woods yet, and then that undermines that confidence.
We have done well now, though. I mean, this week news that the Australian economy grew 1.8% in the first quarter. Now back to where we were before the Black Summer bushfires. That is a remarkable story. How has it happened?
It is a remarkable story. And you might remember, Richard, at the start of COVID, we were saying, you know, is this going to be a V-shaped recovery or a U or a W? And really the answer is it's been a V. You know, that bounce back in economic activity, GDP, the bounce back in jobs has been much faster than we've seen in previous recessions. If we look back to the 80s or 90s recessions, they look much more like U's. So what happened? One, the nature of this shock was different. It was caused by decisions to shut down swathes of the economy for public health reasons. As things reopened, jobs and activity came back fast. But that wasn't guaranteed. There was certainly a lot of economists, myself included, really worried about big second round shocks. You know, when people lose their jobs, they stop spending, when businesses close their door, that has flow on impacts to the economy. And the reason we didn't see those second round effects was basically the huge amount of money that was pumped in by governments, more than $250 billion in support payments. That actually led to a world where business profits increased in the first half of 2020 compared to 2019. Household disposable income went up. That really cushioned the blow and allowed us to kind of ride that upward leg of the V.
It's interesting that key part played by government spending, that is changing. What we can see in the first few months of the year is that shift in expenditure by business and households, and especially business investment, growing faster than it has for a decade. How much does that matter?
Look, it does matter a lot. So that government spending I was talking about was obviously extraordinary spending. You know, that was emergency support payments that could never be maintained at that level. So, you know, what we want to see is, you know, government not vacating the space. And I think government's been really clear they're not flicking the switch back to austerity. They will continue to spend to support the economy, to support demand, to try and create jobs. But you also need that private sector activity kicking into gear for the recovery to really take hold. So that business investment figure that you pointed to, you know, 11.6% rise in machinery and equipment spend over the quarter, you know, the strongest we've seen since the mining boom. I think it really drives home that business confidence has been high. They are putting their money where their mouth is. They're responding to some of the tax breaks and other incentives that have been put in place. And that sort of investment will help drive employment. And that's exactly what we want to see. We want to see a boost in activity and a boost in jobs.
The thing, though, that I think has been underlined over the last week or so, especially in Victoria, is the economic importance of a vaccination, of increasing penetration of vaccines through the population.
Yes, I do not think there is any more important economic issue this year than getting that vaccine rolled out and rolled out to as many people as quickly as we can. While we don't have enough of the population vaccinated, outbreaks of the virus will be handled with lockdowns. And that, you know, really puts a handbrake on the recovery. It puts a handbrake on business and consumer confidence, as I said. And the other point is we can't open the borders until we get there. That is also having an impact. You know, despite those pretty spectacular growth figures you were pointing to, there are parts of the economy that just can't recover while the border is closed. Parts of tourism sector, parts of hospitality, international education, all of those need borders to reopen. And, you know, over time, Australian economy will really feel the loss of migrants, particularly skilled migrants as well. You know, they bring really big benefits to this country. So the economic imperative to get people vaccinated is just incredibly important.
Danielle, that is where we'll leave it. Thank you very much for joining us on The Money.
Thanks for having me.
Danielle Wood is the Chief Executive of the Grattan Institute. Australia is a racist country. That's what most of us think. More specifically, 76% of Australians believe that there's a lot of racism here. That's one of the findings of the Australia Talks National Survey 2021, in which 60,000 of us were asked 600 questions about all sorts of things. So what's the economic cost of racism? Emmanuel Elias from Deakin University has done the maths.
It is first and foremost a human rights problem that depletes the dignity of a person. But racism has also an economic dimension. It is generally considered a source of inefficiency related to the loss of productivity and talent. So racism may be an individual problem if it is very rare. However, there is a cost that society bears when racism is widely prevalent. So we embarked on measuring this cost from a societal perspective because research based on available national surveys showed us that it is widely prevalent.
So how does it work? Is it that racism has an effect on the people who suffer from it, and it's that we can measure economically?
That's right. We can measure the effects of any phenomenon. And we know from a wide body of evidence that racism is an important social determinant of health, definitely. People exposed to racism, they are disproportionately affected by poor levels of mental and physical health. This is particularly the case among ethnic minorities, migrants, and indigenous peoples around the world.
So it's racism causes health impacts, and that's what has the economic effect.
Yeah. People exposed to racism and racial discrimination are disproportionately affected by at least 11 mental illnesses, including anxiety, depression, PTSD, and a lot of other psychological disorders. Racism is also related to physical illness, some kind of physical illness like heart disease and diabetes.
And you were able to work out the cost of those health impacts?
Yeah. Previous studies have used indirect measures to estimate the cost of racism. But in our case, we use direct measures because these indirect measures usually cover the employment-related cost, but they do not capture the overall human cost associated with the exposure to racism.
So what does that come to in dollars?
It translates to around $37.9 billion per annum.
Gosh, what is that in terms of our total economy?
The Australian economy at that time, during the period we measured our estimate, averaged around $1.3 trillion. So our estimation of the cost of racism was around 3% of GDP. So we are saying the Australian economy would be losing somewhere between 2.9 and 3.1% of GDP because of the prevalence of racial discrimination.
Now, you mentioned, and I know you did this research a few years ago, might that figure be higher now?
The figures could be higher or lower, but it depends on several factors.
So what, the prevalence of racism, that would be the key, wouldn't it? That would be the big one.
Yes, these factors can vary, but mainly the key factor is the prevalence of racism. If racism becomes more prevalent in the Australian society, definitely estimations using the same assumptions will go upwards. Also, the reverse would be also true. If racism goes down, then the cost of racism would also go down.
I suppose the question then is, do we know if the prevalence of racism is the same or has it changed since you did the research?
One of the surveys that we used in our research was the Scanlon Foundation Mapping Social Cohesion Survey. And according to this survey, the prevalence of racism for the period 2007-2013 was around 13%. Since we did our research, this has grown upwards to around 18%. So that means the prevalence of racism has increased to some extent.
Right.
Other surveys indicate the prevalence to be stable at an average of 20%. So we have this kind of variation.
How do we compare to other countries, Emmanuel?
We are not aware of any kind of research in other countries that have applied similar methods in relation to the cost of racism. But in the United States, years ago, some researchers have estimated the economic cost of racism using actually indirect measures, employment effects. For example, one study by the economist Andrew Brummer found around 3.8% of loss in GDP for the US economy. This is slightly higher than what we found in Australia. But in 2013, another study by Annie Turner found that by closing the earnings gap for minorities in the United States, the US GDP would actually increase by around $1.3 trillion, which was roughly 12% of GDP. So this is very significant. So I'm not sure which one to take, the Bremer one or the Turner one.
They're both larger than ours. One is sort of in the same ballpark, and one is much, much more significant.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. It does, I think, imply that if we can do work to combat racism, that not only are the people who are victims of racism better off, but all of us are better off, and we can actually show that economically.
Definitely. Racism, as I said, is a societal issue. If it is prevalent, then it's actually costing us, and we are incurring some kind of loss in our economy. Of course, we may not be able to reduce it to zero level, but we can reduce it. By reducing it, we are realizing cost savings.
Emmanuel, it's really interesting research. Thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Emmanuel Elias is at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Globalization and Citizenship. Ah, sunshine, it makes you feel. But is that a good thing when it comes to making decisions? New research, also from Deakin, they're clearly putting something in the water, suggests not, because sunshine has an effect on mood, and mood matters. Associate Professor of Finance Edward Podolsky explains.
I think just intuitively, we all know that we as individuals, although we might have a certain personality, we make different decisions at different points in time, depending on our state of mind.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why that hasn't really been looked at is it's so hard to capture emotions, of fleeting emotions, for a large set of CEOs over a long period of time. So when, together with my co-author team, we came across some research in neurobiology and psychology looking at the link between sunshine and human emotions, especially mood, it became apparent to us that that's the perfect setting to actually look at and study emotions in a corporate context. And also it implied that potentially atmospheric conditions might actually affect corporate outcomes, yeah, which on its own seem really interesting. So that's how we got started.
Okay, now I get it. But hang on, Edward. Sunshine is not a random thing. It's not randomly distributed. If you think about it, Los Angeles and Canberra are sunny places. London and Seattle are not sunny places.
Absolutely, and that's a really good point. However, what is far more random is a fluctuation in a given location. So what we find is throughout the course of a year in a given location, and especially day-to-day fluctuations in a given locations, are quite random. So we held as much constant as possible. So we wanted to just look at, for a single firm, how will its decisions change depending on the sort of sunshine conditions that it's subject to in a given point in time.
How did you look at that?
Essentially, what we looked at is just the sunshine conditions around the firm's headquarters in the period immediately preceding an important information disclosure. So just our study primarily looked at the effect that sunshine has on the quality of information disclosures. So we looked at the average sunshine condition in the 2-week period preceding the announcement, And then we tested whether that has an effect on the quality or bias in the information disclosure. And we found that it is indeed that following sunnier periods, disclosures are more upward biased.
All right. So just to be clear, in the fortnight before companies have to make announcements required by the equity markets they're in or regulators, that's what you were looking
at? Yes, we primarily looked at earnings forecasts, but we also looked at, in general, disclosures, whether they be voluntary disclosures or mandated disclosures. But we were really interested in disclosures, so the information that firms disclose to equity markets in order to inform those equity market participants on the value of the firm.
And you were able to then say, well, there's this much difference between what companies said was going to happen or where they were and where it turned out that they were.
Exactly. With the benefit of hindsight, we could go back to those disclosures and then see, well, what the reality was, you know, say a few months later when we could validate what they were saying.
Now, it wouldn't be a completely unusual thing for a company to say that it's going better than it is. How big an effect did you find?
So there's a few things to note here. So in terms of the average effect, we actually found that the sunshine priming effect has a 20%, it's 20% relative to the effect of other key determinants, like say equity analyst following, et cetera. So 20% of other key determinants of the quality of information disclosures, which seems pretty modest at first. But what we also found is that the effect is very context specific. So in some settings, the effect actually is 6 times greater than the average effect, especially when CEOs are making decisions in uncertain environments, when they have very little or reasonably little experience with the firm, when they are subject to lax external oversight from the media, equity analysts, their own shareholders, regulatory bodies as well. So in certain settings, sunshine can actually be a dominant factor influencing the information quality disclosed by firms, whereas in other settings, so the opposite of what I've just listed, mm-hmm. so when they have, you know, they're in a very certain environment, high levels of experience, high levels of external oversight, the effect can almost disappear. So it's a very context-specific effect.
So a relatively inexperienced chief executive who's not long been at the firm, who isn't being closely watched by their board or regulators, and they bump into a bit of sunshine, the numbers that come out might be wholly optimistic.
Absolutely. And that's the point. I think the broader also implication here is that, so sunshine-induced mood is one element that we're able to capture, but I guess the implication is that emotional states in general then have a far bigger effect on the quality of information. And I would go beyond that. I see no reason why these findings wouldn't also imply that other corporate decisions like merger and acquisition prices offered, for example, wouldn't also be affected. So the effect can be quite large, especially for those individuals in that particular context. So from an investor's perspective, it means you really should be looking out for the context in which CEOs are working in, mm-hmm. and also in some settings, the atmospheric conditions,
yes.
around those decisions, because that will have a lot of bearing for how much sway those disclosures should have on your particular investment decisions.
Now, Edward, one of the things you said has really kind of struck a chord, because I'm thinking many of us probably don't want too much supervision. We want less supervision. We want less being told how to do what we do and having to comply with particular standards. And generalizing a bit, chief executives tend to be confident people.
Absolutely. You know, we can see that CEOs, just like anyone else, will make decisions that are affected by emotions, potentially affected by externally affected emotions, and therefore that will have an effect on their outcomes. What we actually find, and what I think is very interesting, is that those CEOs that are more susceptible to the sunshine priming effect, they actually suffer far worse career outcomes. So taking a step back, we actually look at CEOs over the duration of their careers and how sensitive they were to sunshine-induced decisions. And there's actually quite substantive variation, which makes a lot of sense given that I've already mentioned that the effect is quite context-specific. And those CEOs that throughout the careers tend to make the most sunshine-induced decision, so to speak, they actually tend to serve at far fewer firms as CEOs, have shorter tenures, lower average pay. So it's kind of interesting that these are the sort of outcomes and of being subject to this emotion-driven decision-making.
So the emotion-driven decision-making is less good than less emotionally driven decision-making. And you can actually measure the effect of that.
So that's what we find. And that's what we find in this narrow context of CEOs. But does this mean that emotions in general and sunshine-induced emotions are a net negative in a corporate sense? So for CEOs, especially in the context of disclosures, it would seem that they are. They are not good for investors because it leads to lower quality information. It's bad for CEOs because it leads to poorer career outcomes. But a question I think that's worth asking, and one that I don't currently have an answer to, is, well, what about different stakeholders within the firm? So, for example, creative workers are within the firm charged with technological innovation. Mm. Well, we know that in order to develop technological innovation, you almost need to be a very optimistic and you want to kind of challenge the boundaries and try new things, hoping that things will work out well. So it's entirely possible that this particular effect, although having a negative effect on CEOs' career prospects, might actually be a net positive for other stakeholders within the firm.
The other side of this is that better oversight, more robust compliance regimes actually turn out to be good business.
This is one of those things that probably requires more in-depth analysis just to see, holistically speaking and on balance, is a lot of oversight a good thing? Do we actually want to take away a lot of the freedoms and autonomy away from managers? And I think we almost have to also look at some of these other corporate decisions and how those are affected by sunshine-induced mood. But based on the evidence that we have, it would seem that it's not only good business and for the firm to discipline managers through oversight mechanisms because it ensures that information is more truthful and more reflective of reality. But more importantly, it's also good for CEOs. So although CEOs might want a lower oversight from the board of directors, for example, it isn't always good for them to give them that freedom because it's actually better for their own career prospects if they are disciplined and they can't be influenced by emotions too much when making decisions.
So getting what you want is not always what you need.
All right. Absolutely.
What about an argument then, Edward, for taking chief executives out of their swish corner offices and the like and putting them in the basement? Because that would at least intercept the sunshine.
Good luck doing that, for starters. but the downside there, even if that were the case, what our study shows is not that sunshine necessarily is a bad thing, because it's just as bad when CEOs are exposed to a lot of cloud cover, so little sunshine. They still make distorted disclosures. They are simply more pessimistic then, so overly pessimistic. So in your scenario, if we just close them in the basement, well, essentially, we're just artificially creating downward bias disclosures.
Edward Podolsky from Deakin University. That's it for this week. Thanks to producer Belinda Summer and sound engineer Bryce Halliday. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.